One, two, one, two, three, four.
Hey, hey, it's Shay Keister, and I'm your host for Casual Cattle Conversations, where we talk about all things related to ranching through sharing the stories and practices of different ranchers and their operations. All right, folks, thanks for tuning in. Today, we are hopping over to Michigan, and we get to hear from Jason Roundtree as he talks about grazing management. Jason works in extension at Michigan State University, and he offers a lot of insight on some grazing management practices that can be done today, as well as a big picture view of what it could turn into or long-term things to try. And I really hope you get a lot out of this interview. I know I did. I had fun visiting with Jason. So with that, we'll get on to the interview, and be sure to give me a like, share, follow, and hit the subscribe button. Remember, you can follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and even have a say in the type of episodes that I'm producing. So with that, here you go. Okay, so what is your background in the ranching industry?
Okay, great. So thanks. Yeah. So I actually grew up the son of a dentist in north of Houston, East Texas. We showed livestock in, you know, went to Houston, San Antonio, Fort Worth, Dallas. And primarily, we only showed cattle at a local level, county level. We showed sheep and hogs throughout the state. And so I had zero real hands-on experience other than my 4-H FFA background. My great-granddad worked for the XIT Ranch. I always say that in West Texas. But most all my family's from West Texas, and they settled. My dad settled in the Houston area. So I got super interested in livestock judging. And that was like I ate, breathe, drink. I mean, I love livestock judging. So I went to A&M and judged and had a great time. And then went to, I coached judging teams for 6 years at Mississippi State, Michigan State. And when I was at Michigan State, I started getting much more oriented with cattle production. I was able to train with two of the icons of the cattle industry, in my opinion, Dr. Harlan Ritchie and Dr. David Hawkins. And they are, really just taught me a great deal. And so I had the opportunity to do my PhD at Michigan State working with our Hereford herd here. And when I graduated, I took a job at LSU. So I was in Baton Rouge. It's about 4 hours from our families, my wife and I, and started working with a lot of commercial cow-calf producers then, more so. And most of what I did was work on protein supplementation because our grasses were, we could grow a lot of grass, but wasn't very good quality. And so I worked there, and long story, but I came back to Michigan State and have been working in with a lot of forage efficiency, cattle, carbon footprinting, things like that.
So, but we've talked earlier, and you have your own herd now too. So you're still involved directly with the ranching industry.
Yeah, so we at Lake City, I may talk overly autonomous. Now, my daughter's got a handful of cows at home, okay? And we play with those, and we're probably, unfortunately, I say fortunately and unfortunately, she's ready to show. It's a long story, but we have across our two research farms, I've got about 350 Red Angus animal units. We have a spring and a fall calving herd, and We have been working on those cattle from a really just trying to select for low input, really low maintenance kind of Red Angus cattle. So I've been monitoring these cows for 10 years, and their average mature body weight at weaning is going to be right at about 1150, and their overall frame size is going to be a low to mid 4. And so we've been working on them for quite a while. And so that's kind of serves as the base for all our research that we do.
Okay. So why did you choose to get involved in extension?
I backed into it completely. So when the only reason I went to school was so I could judge. I'm like, that's it, dude. I was like, I was hardcore back in the day. Right. And then I found out I could go to grad school and coach judging teams. So I did that. I wasn't necessarily looking for extension. And premises like my wife and I were in Michigan. We have a child. I'm at Michigan State trying to finish a degree. And then looking for jobs. And the first job that came open close to home was 100% extension. And so I think I was a pretty good fit for it regardless. But I always envisioned doing teaching, honestly, like teaching a lot more, you know. And it just kind of backed into it. And 16 years later, I'm still doing the same thing.
That's awesome. And so you've touched on it a little bit, but what is the emphasis on your work that you do right now?
Oh, you bet, Shay. So our goal, like our outcomes are to model profitable beef cattle production systems that benefit our state, region, and nation. And one of the things we started doing 9-10 years ago is we started measuring a lot of greenhouse gas fluxes. We started measuring methane, nitrous oxide, and how we manage livestock, mm-hmm. what type of reductions we can potentially achieve. We also started measuring soil carbon and actually, you know, looking at the concepts of, well, if we manage cattle in a certain way, are we actually building soil, reducing CO2 emissions, and actually improving things versus all the negative things you might see and hear in the media? Mm-hmm. And so that's been a main driver of what we do, is looking at the mitigation potential of properly managed grazing systems. Concurrently, I have a side deal where I'm really, I love being a Nebraska/North Dakota gal, don't shoot me, but we do a lot of grass finishing also. I'm very interested in trying to make really good tasting grass fed beef. And so we've done a lot of work on managing for grass finishing to improve beef quality. I also do quite a bit with nutritive value, like look at the impacts of management on fatty acid profiles, vitamins, minerals, things like that. So finally, what we want to do likewise is empower our local communities through profitability, right? And so we have worked to try to create value chains that are more localized for producers. We're not a vast cattle state like you are, so we have a lot of different challenges. We're a heavy dairy state. And so we look at ways of adding value for producers on a local level.
Well, that's awesome. So when you look at what producers are doing now, what would you say is one of the mistakes you see them making?
I think without question, livestock producers are leaving a massive amount of production on the table by their mismanagement and their grazing systems. And I say mismanagement, I think most producers often have two jobs. They've got one in town and one at the ranch. So ultimately, the data is clear. If we can move cattle, you know, at best, let's leave them in one spot 3 days, right? You're going to gain 30 to 40% forage utilization. There's been situations out west that use managed grazing that they've doubled their carrying capacity. And so often when I drive through a lot of ground, I don't see any interior fencing. I don't see any cattle managed in a way that they're able to take grass off the situate, you know, take grass off, let it fully recover. I see a ton of continuous set stocking. We just let cattle out and maybe we move them once every 2 or 3 months and move them to a different pasture. There's a lot of challenge to getting the infrastructure of implementing what I call like holistic plain grazing. That's the biggest one. Secondly, I think a majority of the cows are too big. I think that if you really look at the data explaining cow-calf efficiency, I struggle to see why we would ever need a cow over 1,400, but I see a lot of cows that are 1,600 to 1,800, and it's just a very lowly efficient model at that point. We want these – we don't want, like, cows that don't inject growth and production in their offspring, right? I mean, but likewise, often in a feedlot scenario, it can be antagonistic to what's profitable on a cow-calf situation. And that's where seed stock folks, that's the line you tow, right? Yeah. You don't want to get too far one way or the other. But I often think that a majority of our cows are entirely too big.
Okay. So what's something producers could do right now to kind of make that change as far as great management?
Yeah, I mean, often if you look at the aspects of fence and water, those are the least expensive things that a rancher can do to dramatically improve their bottom line. And so typically looking at improving that infrastructure on being able to have more grazing pastures being able to get water to those pastures, I think that's huge. I did the Nebraska grazing roadshow a couple years ago. I worked with Dr. Ron Bowles, who's at Chadron State. Is it Chadron or Chadron, however you say it? And we went from like Omaha all the way to Wyoming, back to Lincoln, up, down, zigzag. And in so many situations, it looked to me that there's just such that we're leaving so much on the table because for cost, infrastructure, whatever the purpose, I don't know. We're just not able to get cattle all over places we need to in a high density way where we're using animal impact. And so what I talk about is like, if you think about how the bison traverse the plains, right? They weren't all spread out. They were in these big tight groups. And they would eat and manure and urine up an area and stomp it. And they'd take off, but guess what? They would leave it and let it recover for like a year or a year plus. And those aspects are how we built the soil in the Great Plains. That's that biogenic, natural, ecological approach is what did it. And if we can't get animal impact on every square meter of land that we're managing and get cattle tightened up in better bunches, we lose animal impact. The minute we lose animal impact, we start fighting deep tap-rooted woody species like cedars, mesquites, and a lot of those things. And so being able to more aptly put cattle where you want them and being able to use every amount of land you can is going to be a huge, huge thing. I think concurrently, in bull selection, if you're in a situation where your cows are getting too big, you can solve a lot of problems just by using bulls that might be a tick more moderate for you. And so those two things, I think, is what I would probably recommend.
Okay. So what about producers who are really struggling on the labor side of things and are worried they might be working that second job? So looking at an intensive rotational grazing system might not be ideal. What about those people?
Yeah, that's hard. I would say that the cost of labor to move cattle once a day is a pretty inexpensive investment if you can improve your overall efficiency of utilization by 30%. It's a pretty cheap investment. I remember reading books, have you ever read any books by Greg Judy?
I have not.
No Risk Ranching. And, I loved like he was talking about as he started. I think it's a perfect book for youth to read because here's a guy, he started, he didn't own any land, he didn't own any cattle. So what he did is he started leasing ground and he started contract grazing. So he wasn't capitalized, right? He had people paying him to manage their cattle. And he would go in and not even have to pay lease, like rent, because he would talk to the landowners, said, hey, I'll improve your land for you. The point I want to make is often he had a day job and he writes stories about having like a headlamp on at night when he got home from work going to move his cattle because he saw how much more improvement he got the more often he moved them. And so if there's a will, there's a way, I would say, but nothing's easy. Like, I mean, I've got a handful of cows at home and like my little 15 acre micro farm, 20 minutes outside of campus. And man, I talk the talk all day. And then there's times at home where I get in, I'm like, damn, I don't feel like doing that. And I don't. And so I get the reality of the situation as well.
So is there any new or upcoming technology that you're excited about from like the grazing management side of things?
Oh yeah, no doubt. Where we are with remote sensing and the opportunities for us to have a cell phone and to be able to understand how much grass we're growing every day or what type of yields our crops are getting every day, growth every day. We're so close. Like, I want to see it before I retire to where we can begin to map on a smaller scale what's happening with energy, with carbon, with whatever. But being able to use remote sensing, RGB, to understand what's going on at the ranch level on our cell phone on a day-to-day basis. That stuff is like, it's crazy, right? And when we get to that point, it's just going to revolutionize how we manage. I had this keen vision that ranchers should be paid for the ecosystem services they produce at the landscape level. That ranching, and we know properly managed grazing, can improve water cycles. It can clean water. It can draw CO2 and put it back in the ground. But in order for those things to happen, ranchers need to be paid for it. And so we've got to find better ways and models that likewise adequately compensate. So it's not that we're just growing food, but we're being paid to produce natural capital for cities and for people. And so that's kind of where I'm real passionate about.
Well, that's really interesting. And it would be definitely beneficial from a financial standpoint for ranchers to be able to receive some sort of payment for the work that they put into the land to improve it, because
right.
I think I speak for a lot of us. We're trying our best to take care of what we have and make the most of it and improve it for the next generation.
Amen. So often we're monetized to be extractive, that, you know, through farm policies. You know, there wasn't long ago where a farmer could have a crop failure. But if he wanted to plant, or she wanted to plant a cover crop to cover the ground, so it blew away, an insurance adjuster would say, hey, you've got something green growing here, and we're not going to give you your crop insurance, your payment, right? So, I mean, there's often these aspects of improper policy that has monetized land, you know, poor land management. It's not a farmer rancher's fault. I mean, they got to feed their family in the short term. And we've just got a real complex deal where often we can't make the right decisions because of outer market pressures, policy pressures, things like that. But I believe, honestly, that if we pay, if we can create a system that, you know, look at a urban city, like look at Des Moines. One has a hell of a lot of water issues, nitrates, there's lawsuits. So many of those problems are the fact that nitrates through fertilizers, through other things, are getting in the water. And so Des Moines, like, faced, well, oh my God, we got to spend, I'm making this up, but $1 billion to build this new huge water treatment thing. But we know that through proper management, we can reverse all that, right? So is it better for Des Moines to build $1 billion water treatment facility or to work with farmers to monetize their practices that keep the nitrates from getting in the water in the first place? And I think that's a much safer alternative versus these huge technological investments. And then it also adds to food security in the process.
Yeah, that is very interesting. I guess that's a venture issue that I hadn't been exposed to that way of thinking, but it makes sense.
Yeah, it does, but nothing like that makes sense ever happens, probably. You know, it's like, I don't know.
So with that, I guess, do you have any other advice for producers right now, or like the upcoming generation as they move back into their families' ranches?
Man, that's a tough one. I think that developing strategies to improve resilience at the landscape level are going to be paramount. Whether it be these crazy water cycles and rain events we've been seeing, I think strategies that keep ground covered first and foremost are going to be the most important, right? Is that you're never exposing land to wind and rain erosion. And I know that's a hard paradigm for a lot of farmers out there, right? But I would encourage young people to more and more think ecologically. Because you know what? Ecologically, we quit fertilizing 10, 12 years ago. I quit. I haven't put nitrogen on my place in 10 years, okay? In Louisiana, when I did wheat and ryegrass, we put out 100, 150 pounds per acre per year. We recommended putting it out on our C4 perennial pasture, our Bermuda Bahia grasses, right? So up here, I quit. And now I've got the data to show my farm is 30 to 40% more productive now per unit land than it was when I was fertilizing. And now it isn't just fertilizer. It's a stacked deal where I've employed different management practices, like our grazing management, as we indicated. I work to keep legumes in my cool season swards. We use no-till. Does it mean I'm not organic? I mean, I've played with some cover crops, so I can come in and put some annuals in to graze. I'll put about, I have used 30 units of N in that situation. I use Roundup. It's okay. And then the point I want to make is that we've improved our productivity by lowering our inputs and by getting rid of a lot of these crutches and band-aids. And that's what I would say is for young people to think about how they can do this in a way that that is reducing their expenses, but yields a lot of ecological returns as well. Because I think especially, Shay, like your age and where you are, there's going to be a time in the future where I think these natural capital avenues are going to come, and you wouldn't be prepared to take advantage of that financially. If you're using extractive farming practices over and over again, your land's not going to improve. It's just a fact. And so that's kind of the deal I have. And I'm not just like bullshitting on this. I mean, I work with McDonald's. I have calls with McDonald's. I've got calls with Tyson, General Mills. I mean, a lot of big companies I'm working with right now, and it's all on their radar because they've all made these commitments to lower their emissions by 30 to 40% by the year 2050. And how are they going to do that if they don't address challenges in their value chain and production agriculture? And so I can assure you that that's where we're headed. And so I would just talk, you know, think about ways of being proactive and doing that. And guess what? In the process, you're getting more productive land that's going to be more profitable for you as well.
So you brought up a point that I think is interesting. So you're in the extension side and get to kind of work with producers, but then you've also just mentioned that you get to work with companies like McDonald's and General Mills. So what's it been like kind of being that middleman?
Well, 10 years, 12 years ago, I was like a lunatic fringe. I mean, everybody thought I was nuts, and we're grass finishing hippies up in Michigan, you know, and it just kind of flipped sometime in the last few years. And I can honestly tell you what I've learned is that never demagogue people. You can say, oh, this person works for, you know, there's people in my circles, oh, McDonald's is the devil, or Monsanto is the devil, or whatever's the devil. Every damn thing's the devil, okay? And what I want to say is that there are always good people everywhere. And there are good people that work for all these corporations. And these good people want to make positive changes societally. So what it teaches me is that always find good people to work with. And those people can make changes and big positive changes in a hurry. And so McDonald's proved that, regardless if you agree or not, by getting rid of gestation crates and battery cages for sows and layers, respectively, right? And guess what? They said, we're not buying pork and we're not buying eggs from these production systems. It flipped overnight. And at some point, I think we're going to start seeing that continually done to say, hey, we're only buying beef grown in this way or whatever. So it's been working with those people has been phenomenal. I get a wonderful glimpse of how the big folks do it, right? And when you start looking at entities that have 50, 100, 150 million acres that fuel their supply chains, then things can change rapidly and for the better. So I would contrast that to working with a lot of friends in smaller things, like I'm on the board of the American Grass-Fed Association, or I work with NGOs that are considerably smaller, right? And they're really good people there as well, probably much more strapped cash-wise. And that limits their ability to make decisions in a hurry. So my philosophy then is to never look at an organization anymore and to look at that human being as just a mere extension of that organization. People are real people, and we've got to find the ones that we can work with and move forward to make positive change.
Yeah, there's definitely great people everywhere. That's kind of been an eye-opening thing for me, just coming to different states and being able to travel to different states as well.
Sure.
So and in being involved in the beef industry too, you get to meet a lot of people, but can make a lot of connections, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that you want to add? I mean, those are all the main questions that I have for you.
No, I think just applaud you for what you're doing. And, you know, if you're ever in this neck of the woods and want to see some Red Angus cows, let me know.
Well, maybe. I mean, I will take you up on that if I ever get over there. I've not been to Michigan yet, so.
Yeah, not many people know we're here. So I like being kind of incognito. So, very good. Well, so nice to meet you.
Well, that's a wrap on that one. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did and had fun visiting with Jason and getting to hear from him. It was fun to hop over to Michigan and get some insight on that side of the country. But with that, thank you for your support so far. I greatly appreciate it. And like normal, tell a friend, give me a like, share, comment. You guys have been awesome. Check out my Facebook and Instagram pages and tune in again.